In the 18th century, Italian physician Luigi Galvani made a discovery that the muscles of dead frogs could be animated to contract and move when touched with an electrical spark. These processes would inspire the crafty to imagine a time when deceased tissue could be animated to a point that it would be able to sustain itself. For all points and purposes, a resurrection of sorts. This process, which would become to be called galvanism, which would be a terminological cognate for its namesake and creator, would become the inspirational flashpoint for the greatest work of Gothic fiction ever to grace classical literature, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. But would an author raised in the white-hot glare of her modern-day progressive politics, conventionally averse to theological terminology and essentially a baseline resistance to any Judeo-Christian worldview, accidentally swerve into one in her magnificent work? Maybe we'll find out today. This is Box Number 7. Let us start this discussion with a parable. Have you not heard of the madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours, ran to the marketplace and cried incessantly, "I seek God! I seek God!" As many of those who did not believe in God were standing around just then, he provoked much laughter. "Has he got lost?" asked one. "Did he lose his way like a child?" asked another. "Or is he hiding? Is he afraid of us? Has he gone on a voyage? Emigrated?" Thus they yelled and laughed. The madman jumped into their midst and pierced them with his eyes. "Whither is God?" he cried. "I will tell you. We have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. But how did we do this? How could we drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What were we doing when we unchained the earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither are we moving? Away from all suns? Are we not plunging continually? Backward, sideward, forward, in all directions? Is there still any up or down? Are we not straying as through some infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not become colder? Is it not night continually closing in on us? Do we not need to light lanterns in the morning? Do we hear nothing as yet of the noise of the grave diggers who are burying God? Do we smell nothing as yet of the divine decomposition? Gods too decompose. God is dead. God remains dead, and we have killed him. How shall we comfort ourselves, the murderers of all murderers? What was holiest and mightiest of all that the world has yet owned has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe the blood off of us? What water is there for us to clean ourselves? What festivals of atonement, what sacred games shall we have to invent? Is not the greatness of this deed too great for us? Must we ourselves become gods to simply appear worthy of it? There has never been a greater deed, and whoever is born after us, for the sake of this deed, he will belong to a higher history than all history hitherto. Here, the madman fell silent and looked again at his listeners, and they too were silent and stared at him in astonishment. At last he threw his lantern on the ground, and it broke into pieces and went out. "I have come too early," he said. "My time is not yet. This tremendous event is still on its way, still wandering. It has not yet reached the ears of men. Lightning and thunder require time. The light of the stars requires time. Deeds, though done, still require time to be seen and heard. This deed is still more distant from them than most distant stars, and yet they have done it themselves." It has been related further that on the same day the madman forced his way into several churches and there struck up his Requiem Aeternam Deo. Let out and called into account, he is not said always to have replied nothing but, "What after all are these churches now, if they are not the tombs and sepulchers of God?" This parable was penned by philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche in 1882. Nietzsche's prose is many times appropriated by the atheistic champions of the philosophical realm, and yet this parable literally circumscribes and describes the ultimate conclusion of removing God from the algebraic equation, that a rudderless ship will ultimately sail into madness, leaving mankind to attempt to replace the sacred guidepost with his own septic imitations, which always, always result in death. By the way, Charles Darwin made the same admission, whether anyone in the scientific realm wants to admit this or not, in his book, The Descent of Man, and stated that his biological conclusions that factored race into his spectral valuations of mankind would create an atmosphere for ethnic cleansing. If you don't believe me, look in his book, The Descent of Man, Chapter 6. Titled Affinities and Genealogy. There you will find your recipe for slavery and ethnic cleansing. And yet, while disturbing, Darwin was correct about the logical conclusions of the devaluation of the human importance and its relationship to something higher. So, when the daughter of 19th century progressivism volleys a gothic horror novel into the genre of scientific fantasy, one can expect such admissions, whether by accident or design. Frankenstein is a literal cautionary epistle against the arrogance of man, his quest for power, and his willingness to place science on the highest throne. The book in no way attempts to make any metaphysical lessons in doing so, although Mary Shelley in her introduction makes this following concession, quote, "I saw the pale student of unhallowed arts kneeling beside the thing he had just put together. I saw the hideous phantasm of a man stretched out and then, on the working of some powerful engine, show signs of life and stir with an uneasy, half-vital motion. Frightful it must be, for supremely frightful would be the effect of any human endeavor to mock the stupendous mechanism of the creator of the world," unquote. Now, this concession could be sarcastic, although it isn't really the general thought about her thinking. Shelley made no bones about the fact that her nighttime visions and meditations brought about the general plausibility of things explored in the novel, and for all points and purposes, God is not a factor in the book. And yet, he is. The book's title, Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus, makes an already mythological comparison to the Greek Titan, the god of fire and creator of mankind from clay. In the Western classical tradition, Prometheus became a figure who represented human striving, particularly the quest for scientific knowledge and the risk of overreaching or unintended consequences. His association with the Caucasus Mountains in Greece also bring the creative and angelic parallels of the Mesopotamians and the Hebrews, which have different names for essentially the same general narratives. The Mesopotamians cite the Apkallu, these giant beings that descended from the sky and brought forth worldly knowledge that both enhanced and corrupted humanity. This becomes even clearer when the scriptural account of Genesis 6 is brought forth. In effect, a cadre of angels rebel against God, marry and reproduce with human women, and give birth to a hybrid form of life that has no official spiritual classification. These angels would provide giant technological leaps into metalwork and science, math, and even the social ramifications of artificial beautification of the face and ultimately the desecration of sexual parameters that would ultimately destroy the purity of man and beast alike. The scriptural accounts are sparse but clear, referenced in Jude and slightly in 1 Peter, at least by allusion. Paul even makes odd references to the relationship of angelic perception and participation to the condition of women's hair during prayer, which by itself is an odd and disconnected statement and makes no sense on its own. As Dr. Michael Heiser said once, if it's in the Bible and it's weird, it's probably important. However, when the Book of Enoch was discovered amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls, it became a literal transparency overlay. In comparison to an incomplete pirate map that requires a second codex explaining narratives that the first century Jews understood quite well, that rogue celestial beings opening knowledge portals to a fallen race was going to cause disaster, and it did. So this accumulation would bring about the flood, a narrative that exists in nearly every ancient culture, including that of Prometheus, whose own arrogance wrought disaster. The only difference is Prometheus is a hero in his narrative. The Nephilim are drowned in the biblical and Enochian account and are cursed to wander the face of the earth as tormented things that never should have existed. Such is the case with Dr. Frankenstein, a man whose first name, Victor, already portends an Olympian nomenclature of ultimacy. The book is also written in epistolary form, which are letters exchanged between two fictional characters to drive the ultimate narrative. This can be turfed off as common literary technique for the day, and it was, but the Pauline structural setup is a little bit noteworthy nonetheless. From this point, we have Victor Frankenstein, i.e. the creator, or quote-unquote father, if you will, giving his time and work to create a son. Right out of the gate, we are confronted with a narrative that is once removed from any celestial value. The father, in this case, a sentient man whose son is the product of a macabre set of assimilations and assemblages, body parts taken from the charnel houses and morgues and no singular identity, mixed and overlapping DNA from a myriad of lifetimes. And certainly no part of Frankenstein exists inside the body of the monster itself. In the biblical relationship of father and son, God's humanity is subservient to his deity and subjugate in his human will to that of his father in the garden. This results in a sacrificial death and a gateway to eternal life. Frankenstein is an aberrant attempt to circumvent the death of non-participants. The monster ultimately flouts the commands of its creators and begins to wreak destruction. At no time does Victor Frankenstein second guess his overarching pursuits, but instead seeks to liberate himself of this monster, not so that he can give up, but so he can try again. In other words, Frankenstein really is playing God, arrogantly thinking that his unhinged scientific pursuits are virtuous in spite of the destructive fallout. In the biblical narrative, a son was given to provide a way out of destruction. Even Frankenstein's pursuits of his own monster find him nearly dead, chasing his unhinged specter on the ice floes of the North Pole, a literal mirror image of the Lake of Fire, or as they say in the occult, an inversion. Now, you might think that this podcast position is to assault the writings of Mary Shelley. I certainly am not, and Frankenstein is one of the most beautifully written books of all classic literature. I am just a person who loves patterns and irony in solidified positions. I remember many years ago in college, I had this Western civilization class, and right behind me was someone who was adorned in all kinds of regalia that very loudly and unceremoniously pointed to the fact that they had a devout adherence to anarchy. I turned around and asked them, "Are you indeed an anarchist?" To which they replied, "Yes, indeed they were." "What are you doing keeping a class schedule, if I might ask?" This was not met with appreciation, I might add parenthetically. And as such, I would assume that Shelley may not have seen her own patterns as well. But because, I mean, think about it. There's nothing more pathetic than an anarchist running across a campus with books under their arms, distressed because they're late for Econ 101. Like I said, I assume Shelley may not have seen her own patterns. Who knows, though? Maybe she did. After all, the first paragraphs of the book are letters written from the Russian city called Archangel. So it starts with Archangel and ends with destruction. Kind of like Prometheus, the book's secondary namesake. It should be noted that most of the time, the very mention of Frankenstein invokes the images of Boris Karloff's famous flat-headed pseudo-Shrek with no vocabulary, green skin and protruding neck bolts. It has an almost cartoonish lack of horror baked into it. Also, we refer to Frankenstein as the monster. Then one day, when we read the book, we realize that Frankenstein is not the name of the monster. Then we start to understand the nature of the book and realize that the real monster isn't the aberrant, galvanistic composite of body parts and mysterious nerve endings. The real monster is, in fact, Victor Frankenstein. And here's where Mary Shelley may have hit upon her most prescient observation. There is something called science, and then something else called scientism. One where the progenitor begins to think his discipline descends from some higher order, and all critics are mere mortals, and all pursuit hiding in the skirts of science are noble, destruction and death notwithstanding, to a place that the scientist himself may declare that they are the embodiment of science itself, instead of a humble practitioner of disciplines, observations, and endeavors. And of course, the renowned scientific process, you know, the one that invites falsification, not the one that ruins the careers of those with contradicting claims. In the 19th century, it was galvanism. In the 21st century, a spinning wheel of obsessive deadly experiments reside within far more anodyne and boring labels, removing any sense of descriptive horror, but unleashing death worldwide. A sanitized procedural label that will bore you to death even before it kills you. In the 19th century, it was galvanism. Today, it's called gain-of-function research, and its adherents are no less godless and vacant than Victor Frankenstein. But their monster is invisible. This is Box Number 7.